Long-haired preachers come out every night to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet, you will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay, you'll get pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie. If you fight hard for children and wife, try to get something good from this life, you're a sinner and bad man, they tell. When you die, you will sure go to hell. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay, you'll get pie in the sky when you die.
Strepus 5. On my way back to the living room, in one of the bedrooms that I passed, I heard coughing, and I seen a red faggot flare up as somebody sucked on a cigarette in the dark. And in the orb of that brief glow, a part of Mr. Hammett's face showed, where he sat alone in an armchair in the corner. He said nothing to me, and I suppose I should have left him sit there by himself. But when my cousin went to jail, he felt bad about it. So I suppose I felt sorry for him, and I really did like his books. I asked him if maybe he'd like another drink. He said, sure. I went and got both of us highballs of scotch. I remember this from one of his books. That he liked scotch. When I brought it back to him, he said for me to shut the door, that the hall light was in his eyes. I did, made my way blind in the dark, handed him the drink. He said, thanks. I sat on the edge of the bed that the armchair faced, and then he said, how do you know Raoul, or Henry? Or Cisco, or whatever the fucking name is he's going by now. I said, Haywire. He thought. He sucked on his cigarette. He blew out the smoke. That fits, he said. He squashed out the stub of the cigarette, sipped his drink, lit a fresh cigarette. I told him how I met him as I watched him doing these things. He said nothing about what I had said. After some silence, I turned his question back on to him.
When I was a Pinkerton, busting unions, he was a U.S. prosecutor. J. Edgar was his marshal. We knew each other then, and later, we were comrades in arms, the Great War, though not J. Edgar. We were to ship together, but I got the flu, then pneumonia. He met Bogey at a cabaret in Paris. It is a story of proportions and details, but I can tell it plainly.
He swallowed down his whole glass. I offered him mine. He thanked me, but refused. I saw then, as my eyes had got used to the dark, that he had a bottle beside the chair on the floor. He sucked on his cigarette. He blew out the smoke.
Did you want me to tell you, then?
He began. I did not answer.
Starving in the winter. Go look for witches in the woods. Unemployment. Dead son of the Pacific, husband come home without legs, afraid of the A-bomb. Look for communists under your bed. The cure to your troubles, distract and blame, fear and finger-pointing. The rich man who owns and controls everything works it every time he thinks you might be watching what he is doing behind the curtain. The story of the hero is always the same, too. It's always Jesus Christ. And there is always Judas, Tom, and Peter, and Mary Magdalene. Always the same passion is told. Always the crucifixion, always leaving us at last to roll away the rock and find ourselves face to face with the question of survival. This lad had been in the crowd at Wenatchee in October of 1912. He had seen the boy who would be his Pontius Pilate, as I had seen him too. But the boy had not seen him. And after all, the boy was at that moment just the boy. We had come to see the president. The president swelled up in wrath like the prophet of Jehovah, spitting fire about labor organizers, the pickers staring up sourly, only there because they were given the time off from work. At his back, the growers smugly stared down at their hired crowd, aware that they had no liking for what they heard. It was more a sermon than a political speech, as I recall it. The president wanted these patriots to join him in the cause of prosperity. But it was prosperity for others than themselves, it seemed to them and me. Gotten from the handle side of their hard work. Still, it was Mom, God, and apple pie, true cause that every good American ought to rally to. The lad I was watching looked on with burning eyes. But he may not have looked to anyone a danger. No wandering Jew, no bomb-maker Slav. He was a fair-skinned Norwegian I had followed from Duluth, where I had been sent to watch the movement. Son of pioneers, having come down off the North Range outside of Bemidji, when the latest bank bust had left too many young men on farms too small. But he had a look which had made my employer, Mr. Pinkerton, take a notice and nod at him for me to follow. Certainly he was always a good judge of the type. He could see a radical by his walk. They were not always the talkers. They were often the ones who spoke only when spoken to. But they were listened to when everyone else had stopped talking. The president pounded his fist. The president railed. He erupted and called death down on the heads of the Reds, but the lad was cold and unafraid. I could see that. I was like him in the uniform of the tramp. A shirt under a sweater, under a vest, under a jacket. My long johns and two pairs of pants and three pairs of socks. You wore your wardrobe. You were your own suitcase. A rider on rails like him, I had found him out at the shipyards where I had been planted in a strike. My task was to find out the leaders and give the names over to be blacklisted. The blacklists were kept by Pinkerton and sold to shippers, growers, lumbermen, whoever hired this wandering labor force, and wanted to keep them paid as little as possible and as docile as possible. Their malcontent worried them like a guilty conscience. And we were hired to shove it back down the hole it tried to crawl out of and to keep it stuffed down there. If there was communist ideology there in that crowd, outside of the few intellectual Jews and the Jesus among them, it was largely in the minds of the bosses, whose guilty conscience had them seeing things they feared, and that they knew were justified. It was the retribution they deserved which they feared. Every time the bosses wronged a working man, they created a communist. Not in fact, but in their minds. The specter of their own cruelty and injustice rising up like the undead from the bodies of their victims. What these poor guys wanted in that crowd there, as I saw it anyway, traveling with him as I had for a couple thousand miles, sleeping up next to them to keep warm, and they against me like brothers, what they wanted was donuts more than dialectics. Love more than liberty. Remember, the revolution in Russia lay at the vanishing point in the distance. No one saw it lying down that road paved with the corpses of all those soldiers. Some of the doomed men standing with me that very day, who had not yet been murdered. We had not even stepped over the body of the Archduke. He still wolfed waffles in Bavaria with brandied chocolate sauce and besmirched his wife's powdered cheek with a sticky smooch. Our magna mater sat on top of the world where the sun never sets. The bruised head of the coiled serpent of crime and error under her heel. Dowager Empress of India with a napkin on her head. I had pictures of her on my tin tea can and my cardboard cigar box. Who would want to overthrow his own old mom? The crowd was let go and not made to return to work because the president wanted to treat them to some hard cider. And the growers calculated the costs to the profit and took what they could out of it. I followed the lad. To tell the truth, it was not an art to follow him. I did not dodge corners and hide behind trees. I walked beside him, his familiar companion. It is easy to spy on a man who thinks you are his friend. Being a detective is largely a bore, and mostly a dishonest practice. If you must carry a gun, you will most likely shoot yourself. So I did not, unless I was told to do so, with the intent that I shoot others on purpose. That happened too, but I never had to do it myself. Blood will spatter these apple pickers, but I was gone by then. So too was my lad Joe. He went down to the river along the dusty gully and into the hobo camp there under the bridge of the train track as the Empire Builder came gathering speed across it. Some cook at a half door waved at us. Joe said he wished to be a cook on a train someday. In the blue shadow of the bridge, it was cool. He found his guitar, he sat and played, and talked about the president. He was a young fellow, but had many strong opinions. He wondered out loud that the president, whom he believed was a hard-working man himself, just did not understand the misfortune of others. "Does it happen," he asked me, "that rich folk just can't see how others live because they have no measure to make of it? If all your life you have had good chances and easy opportunities, do you just take them for granted? So those who have only bad chances and few opportunities must then seem to be folk who you just can't understand and don't believe." He had heard, and had I not heard it too, that J.P. Morgan himself did not know the price of a loaf of bread because he had never had to shop for one. Certain he was that Mr. Morgan had never had to think that the price of a loaf of bread was more dear than all the money he had in the whole world, and nothing else to eat besides, as every one of the rest of us tramps, and a good many more had had to think more than once in our lives. He shook his head, looked at the strings of his guitar, tested them, tuned them, and went to work on a song he was making, for which he did not have any words yet. He was not one to organize, because shy in the first instance, tending to be withdrawn, and there were others who shouted, others who pushed leaflets on idlers and passersby, but he knew when to speak. He could close a meeting and bring it to decision and action. And he sang, and he wrote songs. None of the rest could do this. For these reasons, and for his unflinching courage, he was worshipfully loved by those who followed him. A faithful dozen or so who had collected about him and who protected and assisted him. After I first saw him in Duluth, I followed him. He already had a few followers in addition to me. We headed to Minneapolis by train, got out on the Great Northern Station, and headed into the Gateway District, where three great boulevards converge in a wide area and join up to cross the Mississippi to the old St. Anthony Village. This convergence had once been just an enormous muddy meadow, and later a busy intersection, but the wise city fathers had just finished building a large rectangular park to organize the open space more neatly and to get rid of the mire of manure and mud, with a stone monument to the Grand Army of the Republic there, and had erected a central memorial fountain with a bronze flagpole and a bronze-roofed pavilion with public toilets and a branch library housed in it. Tramps congregated in the park because of the bars, the flop houses, the job markets, and the train station being nearby. There was trimmed grass, gardens, and benches to sit on, and that library and toilet were a real boon for them. They could loiter there all day if they were a mind to. By chance, while we sat on a bench watching pigeons, Joe saw the IWW Hall, an empty storefront without lights that was perhaps abandoned, taken up by squatters' rights, tolerated by a sympathetic or apathetic landlord, a block down from the Union Gospel Mission, as you saw by its large signage, and tucked underneath the Victor Barber College, between a liquor store there and one of the job markets. I followed him to the door. I don't think he even knew what they were about, but he had seen the slogans. The blood red and death black IWW flag hung there. A banner across the window read, "A World Without Bosses." On the wall ahead of us, above the desk of a man in eyeglasses with rolled-up sleeves, was wallpaper of the same single lithograph, side by side by side, entitled "The Pyramid of Capitalist System," illustrating the order of our man-made cosmos in mockery of the early medieval allegory where God sits at the top, looking down on the hierarchy of kings, holy men, aristocracy, and commoners, in spreading circles from one to the many, from the great to the least. Only here, in the place of God, sat a bulging money bag at the top, and tiers below it in this order. First, the figures of politicians saying, "We rule you." Then priests and preachers saying, "We fool you." Then soldiers with rifles saying, "We shoot you." Then rich folk, in formal dress, dining at a huge banquet table, toasting or dead drunk, saying, "We eat for you." And at the very bottom, holding up this colossal layer cake of rank and privilege, the masses of workers, women and children, crushed under struggling to support it, crying out, "We work for all, we feed all." The man in the rolled-up sleeves had a handshake that hurt. He took the Joe right off. I could not see what Pinkerton saw, but this commie did too. Joe never took any pride in whatever it was they saw, if he was even aware of it. I liked Joe, but I liked especially how ordinary he was. What he said when he spoke was always just that simple as well. It was that he stated right and wrong plainly. He did not hate. He did not hate the bosses. He did not hate the scabs. He simply believed that what is fair is due, and he could insist on this without rancor. I suppose that is why, when he closed the meetings, he always brought people to quiet, sober determination. So, when the union acted after he spoke, it was never out of passion, but out of conviction and courage to believe in what is right. In this, he differed a good deal from the cynical speech of our president that afternoon in 1912, which speech would seem to have incited a lynching that night. I was not present. I was told I had a letter at general delivery and went to the train station to see. Instructed to telegraph, I communicated with my employer, who wired me my back pay. I did not carry money when I was on the job, and picked up the next train to Chicago as instructed. I did not see what happened. I read about it in the newspaper in the lobby of the Palmer House in Chicago a few days later, and being one who knew the actors, I could read between the lines of the newspaper to know better what happened than Mrs. Johnson in Minneapolis might ever know. The reporter said an unidentified wobbly had been lynched following his arrest by concerned citizens, read goons hired by the growers, for assaulting a young white girl, read the wobbly had been a swarthy, maybe an Italian or a Slav. The sheriff was overpowered, read he let them take him. And the agitator had been hung as he deserved. Read, a good time was had by all, except that poor guy. I was pretty certain it wasn't Joe. But you could not know. This is how those things were done. A man can disappear from this world with a misprint in the paper as the only stain he leaves behind.
Working men of all countries unite. Side by side for freedom we will fight. When this world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. Well, you will eat by and by, when you've learned how to cook and to fry. Chop some wood, it'll do you good. You will eat in that sweet by and by. Yes, you'll eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high. Work and pray and live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie.